Perturbation theory, just generally, is kind of very much at a foundation of an awful lot that we do in theoretical physics, or indeed in physics as a whole, because we can often find very special exact solutions, and this is even more true with nonlinear theories, but these exact solutions don't necessarily represent the physics that we're trying to describe. And I think the biggest example of this is our universe, where we have the most incredibly simple framework for describing the universe from 13 odd billion years ago to now in terms of the Friedman-Robertson-Walker metric and a single differential equation. And yet that does not represent the universe around it. It represents a completely smooth, isotropic, homogeneous universe. And so the universe we live in is definitely not, because we're here, the planets are here, the stars are here, black holes are here. So we have to describe how those things form. And so the way that we do that is we say, well, roughly speaking, our universe is homogeneous and isotropic, but we're going to say that it's just a little bit of a departure from that overall sort of that main road, if you like, which is the nice exact solution that we can write down on a piece of paper. And we're kind of somehow nearby that. And so when we were looking at the action for gravity, we actually did this calculation. We computed the variation of the Ricci tensor under a variation of the metric. And so we've done almost all the work that we need to do. So rather than keeping on writing delta G, I'm going to use, it's kind of annoying about this, the fact that HAB is used for two different things. But here, HAB is the fluctuation around some known background solution. So forget about first fundamental forms now. So this is our known solution, and this is our perturbation. And it's in some sense small, okay? But I'm putting that in some sense because, as we'll see, you know, this can often depend on gauge. So a known solution might be Schwarzschild or Friedman-Robertson-Walker, or indeed one of these brain worlds. These are the sort of obvious ways in which you first, or sort of the mainstream ways in meeting perturbation theory. So here, I just look at this. Notice that you're doing a sort of divergence, but that between, you know, this is not really a divergence because you've got a covariant derivative in between these two. So in order to massage this into a perturbation equation, I want to just swap the order of those derivatives, which I do using the Riemann identity. Okay, so I just use the Riemann identity to swap the order of derivatives so that now I've got this directly acting on that. So that's going to be important in a moment when we talk about gauges. And so what we end up with is the Lichnerowicz equation, where our, or the Lichnerowicz operator, I should say, So this is Lichnerowicz operator. Sorry, there we go. Now here, this H bar is just a combination of the perturbation and the trace. So in four dimensions, it would be a trace reversed H. So the reason for flipping around these derivatives is actually to end up, if I use the same color chalk, is to end up with this term here. So if you look at the top line is wave operator plus Riemann minus Ricci. So this all looks like things to do with the geometry. Riemann and Ricci are geometrical objects and will depend on the background. Whereas that last bit is some sort of mess of derivatives of the perturbation. So let's just take a look at how to work with this. So the Lichnerowicz. Is the appropriate generalization of the wave equation for a tensor field in a curved geometry. So frequently, when you actually do perturbation theory in practice, you sort of always end up doing something numerical. So in the end, what we're going to be talking about today is more what's happening sort of to get you to that point. But I want to sort of discuss, when thinking about gauge, I want to discuss how many degrees of freedom the graviton has in general dimension. I want to sort of talk about different gauge choices. And then I'm going to specialize to look at this first example in terms of just saying a little bit more about perturbation theory, because that's kind of, whereas say 10 years ago, this might have been the most obvious place where activity was going on in GR around about perturbation theory. I think at the moment it's more accurate to talk about black holes. Okay, so think about gauge. Under a gauge transformation, your coordinates change. So you have your coordinates change by some small amount. And remember, vectors generate coordinate transformations. So here I'm sort of taking psi to be small. Now, of course, that, as a vector, that only has meaning, I guess, in terms of a norm, and it's slightly dubious. But if we go down into the underlying chart of Rn, we sort of have an intuitive feeling we know what a small fluctuation is. So under that, g goes to g plus the Lie derivative of g along psi. So if we do a coordinate transformation along a Killing vector, nothing happens. So that you could think of as spherical polars and just shifting the phi angle a little bit. Nothing happens. Your metric is still the same. Okay? But if you were to shift along theta, for example, then you would get a little bit of a mixing up of the components. Or if you were to rescale r, you would get a bit of a shift in some of the components of the metric, just because you've chosen to label your coordinates differently. So this is our g naught plus grad a psi b. Plus grad B psi A. So here you see that the coordinate transformation, if psi is not a Killing vector, generates a perturbation. So how do we distinguish between physical perturbations that actually change the space-time around us and pure gauge ones? And that's actually at the root of a lot of the sort of really tough issues that we had with numerical relativity. So let's have just a look at our H bar. Hang on. So if I take the divergence of that H bar, here I've got grad A psi B and grad B psi A. So the first bit gives me just the wave operator acting on psi. The second bit gives me two derivatives. And the third bit gives me two derivatives. But notice if I pop that one, well, hang on, let me put this one up and that one down. And you see this is just the Riemann identity. So I get ox psi plus RAB times psi. So this is now a curved space wave equation for a vector. And it's actually, because this is now a sort of standard well-known hyperbolic equation, this is a well-posed equation. So you can actually solve it if you give it some initial data. So that's kind of some sort of, I guess, applied math type of argument. So what that means is, if we've got an H in which the divergence of H bar is not initially zero, it means we can do a coordinate transformation. We can solve for a psi to match that non-zero divergence and then give us a new H which has vanishing divergence of the H bar. So this is really just about arguing that you can cook coordinates so that that final term in that generic Lichnerowicz operator is made to vanish. And this is called the Dodonda gauge. Or sometimes you'll hear transverse trace free, but that's not quite the same. Transverse trace free means that H is zero, using the A's, as well as the divergence of H. So normally, when people actually talk about the graviton, they're really talking about transverse trace-free. But be careful, that only works in vacuum. If you have matter, you cannot take both, you cannot take the trace, for example, to vanish necessarily. So that's just a word of caution. So that's the most common gauge that you'll see in relativity. But other ones that you might see, I'll just note them. So we've already actually seen this gauge, Gaussian normal, and that's where you have a single coordinate sort of orthogonal to a surface, and such essentially here you fix gz, delta gzz is delta gz mu equals zero, or delta gzA, I guess. So there you do not have typically So really, what the gauge you choose should be catered towards the problem that you're trying to solve. So if you have a brain world, it's usually more convenient to have coordinates that respect that decomposition of space-time that you have. And so you might be prepared to sacrifice the extra algebra for computing that divergence of h-bar. But just in general, the Dodonda is what people use, because then your wave equation gets just a little bit simpler. So let me just carry on with that train of thought of Dodonda. And I want to just think, okay, I've set that divergence of h bar to zero. What else can I do? Is there any gauge freedom left? Well, if there is, it would look like that in the bottom right-hand corner of that middle board. My x would go to x plus chi, and the only way I can maintain the Dodonda gauge is if this wave equation here, box chi plus Ricci chi, is zero. And again, that has solutions. So it's D equations and there's D solutions, even if they're all coupled, just sort of simple counting. So if I now say, okay, I started off with an H, I've chosen a gauge, so that's given me some restriction. I've still got some remaining gauge freedom. What's left? So that's the final sort of counting of degrees of freedom.
Sorry, setting the Dodonda gauge, setting that to be zero, doesn't that take your gauge degrees of freedom to do that?
You're using some of them, yeah, but not all.
Why is it less than D?
You'll find out. Let me do my counting and then ask the question again. So we start off with HAB, right, which is symmetric. So it has D into D plus one over 2 degrees of freedom, right? So it's got a lot of degrees of freedom in general. So then we have to minus the Dodonda. Now that has, we're using D equations because B goes from 0 to D minus 1. So I subtract D from my total number of degrees of freedom. So if you think about it just algebraically, you start off with this many different independent components. You've got D equations here. So you can think about using those D equations to eliminate D of those components. Then you're left with a certain number. So it's now going to be D into D minus 1 over 2 different degrees of freedom. However, you know that you can make gauge transformations which satisfy your choice of gauge. So you know that of those dd minus 1 over 2, you know d of those are gauge degrees of freedom. So what you're left with is the physical degrees of freedom. So that's what you're left with, physical degrees of freedom.
If you wanted to impose the de Donder gauge, wouldn't you have to first start with changing your coordinates such that you can make the, sorry, what's that letter, the squiggly one? I forget the name.
Which one? Psi.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, there's this one.
Oh, that's chi.
Chi. Right. So don't you need to sort of make your coordinate transformation and use a chi to fix your...
No, chi does nothing to your choice of gauge. Chi satisfies that wave equation, so chi does not contribute to the divergence of h-bar. So you first set h-bar to zero, this divergence of h-bar. That gives you d equations. And if you just thought about simultaneous equations, you would use those d simultaneous equations to knock down the number of components that you're dealing with by D. This is just in general, right? And then you'd be left with D into D minus 1 on 2 different bits of H. But then you would say, okay, but some of those degrees, some of those functions are gauge degrees of freedom, and that's that argument there. That's not what you do in practice. What you do in practice is you say, I have the de Donder gauge, therefore, you know, I just use it to sort of relate different components of H. I find some solutions, and then I have to worry about whether they're physical or whether they're gauge. So, I mean, for example, in cosmological perturbation theory, there's quite a bit of effort that goes into taking sort of combinations of the perturbations that are physical, you know, that you can't gauge away, or writing what's left, you know, of the fluctuations in terms of something that you know is physical. So some of the time, some of the work is in identifying physical perturbations. So here, for d equals 4, n is 2. So you have two propagating modes for the graviton. And if you'd find an exact solution for a plane gravitational wave, you sort of see that they have two polarizations. So a gravitational wave will take a circle and it'll either squash it sort of along axis, or it'll squash it like off axis. So you get those two different solutions. Those are the sort of main polarization states. And just to note, in d equals 5, n is also 5.
Sorry, I'm still kind of confused, because when you change your coordinates from x to x plus c, you have that equation, and then you set the divergence equal to 0, then you call the Donder gauge, and then you said, okay, now if you move your coordinates with a chi, you have the same equation, you set it equal to 0.
Yeah.
But couldn't you just say, I'm choosing c in such a way that that is always equal to 0, I'm choosing those c's? Because...
That's what you're doing. I'm not changing x. I am observing here, at this point, what I'm observing is that amid all the solutions that I find in that de Donder gauge, I've got d that are rogue, right? They're not physical fluctuations, they're just gauge perturbations. And in this format, without a background and without an explicit set of solutions, it doesn't, it's not necessarily the case that you can grasp on to what these chi's are, but you're first sort of saying that I'm choosing the de Donde gauge. You can either regard that as this sort of rather applied maths argument of solving to find a xi, or you can say, which is really what you do in practice, that I have the de Donde gauge, therefore I've got these d equations here, and I use those to eliminate d of these components. Then I'm left with d into d minus 1 on 2 possible independent solutions. So I find them. Then I have to stop and say, okay, but how many of those are physical? And that's where it gets harder, because you have to make sure that what you've found is a physical perturbation. So it's not unknown that people have found a solution to a perturbation equation and said, oh, I've got this fluctuation that's doing something crazy, and it's just a gauge fluctuation, okay? That's not unknown. So I'm not saying that you can reduce H further using this. I'm just saying that this warns you that some of the solutions you find could just be gauge solutions and not physical fluctuations.
How did you find this though? I mean, I know you just put, instead of C, you put chi there because that's also a corner transformation, and then you set that equal to zero. But you already did that. Well,
no. I'm just saying, this is a coordinate transformation, right? That's always a coordinate transformation. And my question was, can I make coordinate transformations which don't affect my gauge, choice of gauge? And this tells me I can, okay? So that just tells me, yes, you can, be careful. That's what that's telling me. It's not telling me I don't care what chi is at the moment, a priori. It's just like a warning that once I've found these solutions, my job is not yet done. Yeah. So I have to be careful. Okay, now I want to just talk a bit about black holes. Now, this is where things start getting really messy. So back in the 50s, Reggie and Wheeler looked at the perturbations of a black hole. So they went into the de Donde gauge. So that was the first sort of step. And because, so let's, this is Schwarzschild, right? Not Kerr. So we have dt as a killing vector, and we also have three angular killing vectors. But in particular, we've got d phi. That's the one that always sort of floats around. So the fact that your background has so much symmetry is very encouraging. It sort of tells you how to think about the perturbations. So in other words, you have a frequency which is associated with t. So that corresponds to d by dt. And you're also going to have an angular momentum, let's say L, which is sort of corresponding to this triplet. Essentially, you're going to have L and M, which corresponds to the sort of normal angular momentum quantum numbers. Now, with scalars, you can find your angular momentum eigenfunctions very easily. They're sort of given just in terms of Legendre functions. But as you can imagine, I really don't want to write it down. I didn't bring the Reggie Wheeler paper. But as you can imagine, it's kind of complicated, right? So even in four dimensions, you know, we have, oh God. So we have 10 independent components of each. So basically this paper is all about taking those 10 independent components, asking what the de Donda gauge does so that you can knock it down to 6, but then also thinking about how these components couple to each other, because Lichnerowicz is a nonlinear equation. It couples different components together. So a lot of their work was in noticing that your if you decomposed your perturbations in the right way, angular fluctuations of a specific angular momentum, these would just sort of stay in a sort of independent representation. So we have, they've also noticed there were even and odd perturbations. So this is parity. So again, the Lichnerowicz operator didn't mix parity perturbations. But what you notice is that there's no S wave, so that's L equals zero. So there's no S wave solution. So just as an example, an S wave would be would have that form. It would have no angular dependence at all. And it would just be of this form where you would then use your de Donda conditions. If you're in vacuum, you probably use transverse trace free. So you would relate K to the H's, and then you would actually reduce everything down, in this case, to a single physical function, as well as a sort of gauge degree of freedom. So that would be an S wave. But then, just to give you an example of an odd M equals zero, they managed to bully that down into the following. Into that form, and I think that was the one that I decided was the shortest that I was going to write down on the board. So it's a very, you know, sort of, there's a lot of algebra going on in that paper, but here you kind of see the sort of idea of what's going on. Here you have a mixed perturbation, which is occurring just in the phi components, the cross terms, T phi and R phi, and here you see where your Legendre functions are coming in. So typically what happens, you find your scalar harmonics, and then you kind of use those harmonics to build vector harmonics, and then you use the vector harmonics to build these tensor harmonics. So each time you step up from scalar to vector, vector to tensor, the work just explodes. And you really have to sort of do, you know, turn a lot of handles to get things into a simple form. So the odd parity perturbations are sort of easier, if you like. They boil down much more quickly to than even parity perturbations. So this one, for example, boils into the following equation of motion. So actually, let me label that instead of the effect, let me label it with L. So the reason I thought I would just write this down is because this sort of general shape here is quite a common endpoint. You're decomposing here, you're decomposing with respect to the symmetry of the background. You've sort of separated out your fluctuations as much as possible. So, I mean, parity even, parity odd, we have a notion physically of what that means. So it's appropriate that they should be sort of, they shouldn't couple to each other in any sort of fluctuation or perturbation equation. And then it's just a case of trying to get them in the simplest possible form. And I've kept m equals zero again, just to keep things clean. So you can see how this is a very, this L into L plus one is the common angular momentum eigenvector, eigenvalue. And of course, m here is zero. But you, what you see is you've got this, this R star is of course the tortoise coordinate. And so here, this is like a sort of standard Sturm-Liouville type of an eigenvalue problem. If I call this thing Q, you have something that looks like Q double prime plus omega squared Q minus some potential times Q equals zero. And so this is, if you like, this is the challenge. This is what you have to find a solution, a radial eigenfunction for this Q. So I wanted to,
how do you go about finding the eigenfunctions and eigenvalues? Is it like you take a Lie derivative and you find the eigenfunctions of the Lie derivative?
No, it's so, I mean, basically you read this paper once and then it's like a rite of passage, you know? But how do you find it? So first of all, you are actually, when you come to perturbation theory, you come with a knowledge of the background and you always use the background to simplify the perturbations that you're looking at. So in this case, the background has time translation symmetry. It has the SO3 group. And so you know that what you've got has to have some, you know, you essentially say, I'm going to set H is, well, you know the T one, right? So you know H is going to be e to the minus I omega T, because that's mu d by dt. And then you're going to say, well, I expect it's going to be an H of R, and then, you know, some sort of, let me call it G, I don't know, of theta and phi. But I kind of know, again, because of the killing vector, it's going to be e to the I m phi. So before I've even started, I've already made things a lot easier, okay? So then you sort of put that in. Then you know that, again, it's sort of using some of the lessons that you've learned from doing scalar and vector harmonics. So it, you know, so that's kind of how you gradually build it up. And I mean, I dread to think just how many pages of paper those guys used before the final version, right? But it's to some extent you end up sort of writing down that equation, right, in all the components, and you just write down each of them. And then you use, I guess, your experience from other problems to start sort of making a guess, having a stab at what it might do.
So this differential equation comes from the
Lichnerowicz, yeah. So where it's come from, you see you've got the H naught and H one. So first of all, you've got two first order equations. And then you combine those to eliminate one of the variables to get a second order, because, and the people seem to like people seem to like sort of splitting it up into this format with no first derivatives, because then they go, ah, Schrodinger equation, right? I don't know, I did a maths degree, so I don't care about first order derivatives as long as it's self-adjoint, you know? But this is the conventional way of thinking about it, because here, apart from the, you know, you can view this as like a Schrodinger type of equation, sort of in a, you know, this in a sort of steady state, right? And so so people have an intuition developed via that route. So anyway, yeah, it's a lot of work, trust me. So the first thing I wanted to talk about, having, you know, I wanted to talk about a little bit to do with each of those two formats, the S wave and also that sort of general equation of motion there for Q. So I'll start with the S wave one. So that's first example. It's a black string instability. So what's this? This is where you have this Schwarzschild cross R solution in 5D. But you also have in 5D a black hole solution. So the 5D solution Well, let me just write down what a black hole is in D dimensions, because I don't think we did this. So a black hole in arbitrary dimensions is very similar to a black hole in four dimensions. You just have the appropriate Newtonian potential type of thing in front of GTT. And then you identify the mass really by sort of looking again at the fall off at infinity. That's your ADM mass. So for the string, if you ask what the mass of the string is, you find you get m no matter how long it is. It's just one of those sort of slightly weird things, in the sense of, as you, if you think of this as a Kaluza-Klein compactification, the bigger you make L, the smaller you make G4. So in fact, the real mass of the string is M. And then S black string is the area, 4 pi r plus squared L, divided by 4. So that's 4G5. But then I relate r plus to M, so that's equal to 4 pi G5 M squared on L. So my R plus is equal to 2G4M, which is 2G5M over L. So that's what I get. Meanwhile, this thing, my mass is, so we've got masses that mu, so here we have R5, if you like. So it is 3, d minus 2 is 3. The area of a 3-sphere is 2 pi squared. I've got r5 squared, sorry, over 16 pi g5. And so I can relate the mass of the 5D black hole to the square of the radius. Then I calculate the area to get the entropy. So again, the area now of the three sphere goes like R5 cubed. I want to replace R5 with the mass. So the mass is related to R5 squared. So here I've got something that's related to m to the 3/2. So the black string scales like m squared on L, whereas this just scales like m to the 3/2. So they have different scaling depending on whether it's the string or the black hole. So if I look at these entropies, I take the black hole to the black string. So I take this and divide by the other entropy. So you kind of start cancelling various bits of pi, and you see that you've got an 8 on the bottom line there. So you end up with 8 over 27 pi, and then it's L over root G5m. And I can get that ratio of entropies into something that is a constant, and then you're looking at the competition between L and R4. So this G4M here is just R4 over 2. So in other words, you're looking at how skinny the cylinder is. So what this indicates is if you make the string too long, entropically, it's not actually the preferred state. So that's the sort of reason why you might think there's an instability of that black string. So then you go and look for an instability, because after all, it's actually easier to prove an instability than stability. Because all you have to do is find one thing. So a general metric would have that form, but nothing depends on Z, so that's why I put e to the I mu Z. And then what we did was we looked just for a radial, an S-wave type of fluctuation. So something that didn't depend on the angles. So the reason I just wanted to do this one equation in detail is A, because it's very simple, and B, because it's sort of, it's talking about how you look for solutions. So this is the four-dimensional equation for H in terms of the Schwarzschild background, so that F is the Schwarzschild F. And what you see is that from here, you've got a four-dimensional wave operator and a mass term. So it looks like a 4D massive wave equation. And actually, if you do the decomposition of the Lichnerowicz operator, that is a generic statement. So it's a four-dimensional massive wave equation. And coming back to the questions about the chi, what that tells you is if you find a solution, it's physical because of that mass squared term, because anything that's gauge will only ever satisfy the four-dimensional vacuum equation for a massless with no mass. So the fact that this is a massive wave equation, this tells us any h is physical. Now this one, H55, if I look at what happens, as R tends to infinity, so this is again a typical technique, you see that H55 looks like e to the plus or minus root omega squared plus mu squared R. So for us to have a regular solution, we have to choose the decaying branch here. As R tends to 2gm, H double prime plus H primed over R minus 2gm is 2gm omega squared over R minus 2gm squared H. So you can see that H is going to be proportional to R minus 2gm to some power. So if I sketch my H, my H starts at zero here, it's tending to zero at infinity, so it's got to have a stationary point in between. If H primed is zero, and I look at my equation of motion for H here, that means that H double primed has to be proportional to H. So that would be greater than zero if H were positive, but a maximum requires H double prime less than zero. So there's no H, no solution. And then the vector equation, H mu 5, is similar. So you end up just going and analyzing the tensor equation. And that's where you have to sort of get involved in numerics. So we can't actually write down the solution. So our equation for the H mu nu has a sort of similar form. And what it really is just an eigenvalue problem for mu. Sorry, for omega. So you integrate in, I mean, one, this is just because this is a simple enough problem, you integrate in the regular solution. And what you find is near the horizon, you've got a sort of a combination of the good solution and the bad solution. And so you identify you identify the distribution between the good and bad solutions, B on A, and then alter omega and watch how it changes. And so what you're looking for is a zero, so you just simply look where, as you shift omega, you're looking for a zero of this B on A. So for the black hole, so that's, and that's how you find it, and so you sort of get this plot of sort of omega of mu, and you see that you have an instability for a whole range of mu that actually corresponds pretty well to that, to that sort of 27 pi or whatever it is. So for just to finish off, if you're looking at these equations here for a ring, for the black hole, the solutions for black hole perturbations, it's actually a very similar type of argument. You're looking for your Q, you know that it goes like e to the minus I omega t minus r at infinity, and e to the minus I omega t plus r star at the horizon. So why do you know that? Because the t minus r solutions here are outgoing waves, so you're assuming that there's nothing coming in from infinity, and you know that the black hole is an absorber, so you have to have only ingoing waves. So at this point, you know you're going to be in trouble if you're looking for a solution for omega there, potentially in trouble, because if you've got waves going out at each end, that's something where you're losing energy. So you have a dissipation in the system. And so you can sort of compare this with the damped harmonic oscillator. So here, this is just meant to be extremely heuristic, but here, if you have a damped harmonic oscillator, that's where you've got dissipation in terms of energy, and you see that via a complex eigenvalue. And so this is kind of indicative that when you're looking for this eigenvalue, the omega squared in that Q equation is like an eigenvalue, then you're looking for a complex eigenvalue. And so what you do is you have to do this numerically. There's a lot of very nice techniques, and people find these complex eigenvalues, and these are called quasi-normal modes. And just as your simple harmonic oscillator, the one that has the complex eigenvalue, you know, when you actually ask what does that look like, it looks like some decaying amplitude times an oscillatory piece. That's your damped harmonic oscillator. Here you see that your amplitude, same with the quasi-normal mode, but this, if you like, is it has a sort of given frequency. So we usually call black holes, you know, like it's the sound of the black hole. So you have the black hole ringing, if you like, at that given frequency, but it's decaying. So this is what happens after a black hole merger. Once you're ripped past the hugely nonlinear phase, then you use these quasi-normal modes, the black holes sort of starts off, you know, completely where there's no way you could ever describe it at all mathematically, but very quickly it settles into this sort of ring down phase where it just sort of emits a very characteristic frequency with a characteristic damping. And so that's kind of the last stage of a black hole merger. The initial stage also, it depending on the various mass ratios, you can also use perturbation theory if it's an extreme mass ratio. So these analytic tools don't get you all the way, but they get you quite a long way towards the answer, and often by just stepping back and maybe accepting you don't have all the details, you can kind of deduce what sort of phenomena are going on just by thinking about, you know, here it was just thinking about, well, obviously stuff has to fall into the black hole, so it's going that way. Stuff, you know, I'm not going to have a conspiracy of boundary conditions with something coming in from infinity, so something has to be going out, and therefore that is a dissipative system, so I'm looking for something that decays. So, okay, stop there.
Could you explain again how the entropy argument is related to perturbation?
So the entropy argument tells you that if you make the black string too long relative to its width, the black hole has a higher entropy. So thermodynamically, that tells you the black hole is preferred. So this is sort of one of these examples where using these concepts, well, first of all, thermodynamics is a classical concept, right? But applying it to black holes, you inevitably end up drifting into quantum, or perturbative, at least, quantum field theory. So in giving a black hole the interpretation of entropy is nowhere in classical GR. So, but you're using those ideas from black hole thermodynamics and saying, they tell me that that black string is unstable. So then you go and look to see, is there an instability? And you find one.